Welcome to KABU, Joshua Frank. It's good to have you on the Olmo Variety Hour this morning.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're a journalist, a managing editor of Counterpunch, and author of several books, including your most recent investigative work on the Hanford nuclear site titled Atomic Days: The Untold Story of the Most Toxic Place in America. You'll also be joining me and others to introduce the new documentary film, Atomic Bamboozle, at upcoming theatrical screenings in Portland and Vancouver, Washington. And perhaps we can talk a bit later about those events. But let's start with the subtitle of your new book. What is the untold story of Hanford, and how did you take up the position of storyteller?
That's a good question. I started looking into Hanford about 10 years ago. I was doing some pieces for Seattle Weekly, and I was given a trove of documents from a union lawyer who represented a bunch of workers out at Hanford. From those documents, I wrote two really long investigative pieces on a couple of the largest whistleblowers that Hanford had seen in decades. So fast forward 10 years later, I learned a lot during those years investigating those pieces. And I came away realizing that there was just so much that wasn't known outside of definitely not, outside of the Pacific Northwest, but even in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of people weren't really aware of the legacy of Hanford, of some of those whistleblower stories. And just some of the sort of people's story of what happened to Hanford in the region. So I wanted to put that all into, a cohesive book, and fortunately was able to do that. And now it's out in the world, and fortunately people are reading it a little bit.
Including the Revolutionary Readers Program in Vancouver, Washington, which we could perhaps talk about before we close today, how your book was selected for that, which was quite an honor. And it's certainly a gripping read and a horrific story, a kind of graveyard of the legacy of the nuclear weapons and nuclear power joined
Yeah.
industries and projects. But you also open with that you have reason for hope. So maybe we could get to the reason for hope
Sure.
before
Yeah.
we stop today. But I'd like to ask you about this contradiction of the legacy that troubled me in my own work on visit to Hanford and struggle with how to cover that in the film Atomic Bamboozle, how to make demands that the federal government fulfill its obligations to clean up the site, which it has failed to adequately do, and the tribes and other groups have really pushed for that cleanup funds. And at the same time, you point out the rampant corruption in how those funds are used and how contractors are, as you say, making out like bandits. Do you want to first talk about those two aspects of the legacy and how you struggle with those conflicting aspects of the Hanford toxic waste sites?
I think first, just for people that might not know the intricacies of what Hanford is, Hanford was a location that was chosen for the Manhattan Project. And the job out there was to produce plutonium for atomic weapons, which it did for decades during the Cold War. And of course, all the way back to World War II, it produced plutonium for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. And during the course of producing all the plutonium, a bunch of waste was made, right? Today, what they're dealing with out there are 56 million gallons of highly radioactive waste. That's two-thirds of all the highly radioactive waste in the country is out at Hanford. Much of it is sitting in these big, hulking underground tanks. 67 of those tanks have leaked over the years. The tanks are only supposed to last, a couple of decades. They're only, 6, 7 miles from the Columbia River. Right now, two of those tanks are leaking highly radioactive waste into the soil, which will make it to the groundwater supply and eventually to the Columbia River. We have a lot of evidence over the course of this operation that it was already polluting the Columbia River as well as, the nearby region. So today, what they're dealing with is trying to, we call it a cleanup. And I think it's, you know, I put quotes around that because really, what does that mean? And in my view, that means just let's get this, the site to a safe place. I don't know if it ever can be truly remediated in the sense that it will be once what it once was. Plutonium itself, you know, it's radioactive for 250,000 years. To put that in perspective, you know, humans have only been roaming outside of Africa for 60,000 years. So this stuff sticks around, you know, insurmountable amount of time. So the cleanup is kind of a misnomer.
Just to stay on that point a bit,
Sure.
the Yakama Nation has defined cleanup as the capacity of the region to support life and
Yeah.
fishing and other forms of usual and accustomed practices that were
That's
also
right.
promised by treaties to the tribes by the U.S. government. And so, is that consistent with your more modest ameliorative
Well,
criteria?
I think that the Yakima have every right to that aspirational goal, and I hope that that one day can be achieved. But we have a long way to go. And right now, you know, those tanks are so full of, there's so much waste out there, 56 million gallons, right? That we need to figure out what to do with it. And since the inception of Hanford becoming cleanup site, which happened in the late 80s when it stopped producing plutonium, so at the end of the Cold War, it immediately turned into a cleanup operation. And if you go back and read some of these early press releases by the companies that were tasked with cleaning this up or turning, you know, getting this waste into a safe place, it was pretty rosy projections. They thought, oh, in about 2 or 3 years, we're gonna just vitrify this stuff, turn it into glass, which is vitrification, and it'll be great. And we'll be done by 1995. And well, billions and billions of dollars later, and it's 2023, and they haven't vitrified anything. In fact, just last fall, they had a test operation up and running to do a test run of vitrification for low-level waste. And the facility that they spent billions of dollars on, or millions and millions of dollars on, at least, overheated. So it didn't last very long, right? And so they're back to the drawing board. And meanwhile, we're covering that. We're paying for that. Taxpayers are paying for this project.
And that's a long-standing habit of the
Absolutely.
nuclear industry in general.
And part of the
Granted,
military industrial complex in general, right? And Hanford was born out of that. I mean, it was a covert military operation for decades and became essentially what I would argue a covert cleanup operation. The Department of Energy is in charge of the cleanup out there. But as Donald Alexander told me, the whistleblower that was worked for the Department of Energy, a high-level scientist there, he said, you know, it's not that the Department of Energy doesn't have the right goals. It's that they don't have the technical staff to oversee the project. So much of that work is handed over to the contractors. In the case, the biggest contract out there is Bechtel, and Bechtel runs the show. They are the ones that are pocketing all this cash. They are the ones that push through design projects. It's such a complicated process. You know, there's so many different aspects of the cleanup that every one of those has to go through a design and, you know, a scientific panel and overview. And the Department of Energy just doesn't have the staff to oversee this project. So Bechtel often is pushing through shoddy designs. Then they go back to the drawing board. Meanwhile, they're getting paid, right? These are cost plus contracts, which means, you know, if you can think about it, if anybody's ever remodeled their kitchen or something and the contractor says, oh, it's going to be $10,000. Oh, well, in the end, it ends up being $20,000. Well, multiply that by billions of dollars, and that's what we're seeing at Hanford. They keep going back to the drawing board and saying, oh, it's actually going to cost this much more. We, you know, we didn't quite do it right, or it's, you know, costs have gone up. It's a lot more complicated than we thought. But this has been the modus operandi out there for, you know, 30 years.
What
And
about the role of the tribes and the state of Washington in reining in some of
You know,
those
the Washington
practices?
Department of Ecology, which is essentially the Washington's EPA, you know, they're very good. They issue a lot of great reports. They do their best to hold the Department of Energy accountable. The tribes have a lot of input, and I write about that. The legacy of Russell Jim in particular, who really was the catalyst for the input that now the natives have there. And all of that is very, very important. Any big decisions that get made out there, the Washington Department of Ecology and the state of Washington and the tribes, they have a seat at the table. But ultimately, this is a federal project. This is run by the Department of Energy, and the contractors still are the ones that run the show out there because it is a for-profit enterprise. And we've seen the effects of that really nothing has been done. Yeah, they've remediated some soil that had chemical contamination. They did take some elements out of some of these tanks. But in doing so, they kind of created other problems. And meanwhile, we're footing the bill. So, I think my hope is that this is the call to action that it needs to change out there. Also, the Government Accountability Office at the federal level issues really great reports, and very critical reports of Bechtel, basically calling them out and saying that they need to be removed from the project, and indirectly saying that, and sometimes directly. And little has been done because it is such an immense project that very, very few companies can carry out this type of work. And then when you have a department that's overseeing it, that's very underfunded, and even, got gutted again, kind of like the EPA was under Trump. I mean, it's been a systemic problem for the Department of Energy. We're dealing with a huge problem. But when there's money involved, often, corruption tails behind, and that's what we've seen at Hanford.
You also take up the impact of those very corrupt policies and practices on workers at Hanford. And I think that's a lesser known story than the leaks and the toxic legacy of Hanford and the Manhattan Project on the lands and the local habitat. What were you hoping to say from a labor perspective? Because your own work is very much tied to promoting and acknowledging the impacts of these kinds of military industrial projects on workers.
Yeah, I think that it's part of the story that I don't want to be overlooked, that there are a lot of people out there that have the same vision for the future as we do, as those that are critical of the cleanup, but they are caught in a very corrupt system which perpetuates these problems. And in the case of a lot of the workers on the ground out at Hanford, it has been very detrimental to their health, right? There are unions out at Hanford, and they have negotiated good contracts for the workers. They make good money. But ultimately, we've seen a lot of instances where these workers have been exposed to highly chemical vapors, for instance, that have caused horrible illnesses. And those workers have been fighting for years to get compensated for that. Fortunately, the state of Washington has passed legislation that was trying to be fought by the Trump administration, and it went back to the drawing board. But now they're going to be compensated. But it's still a long process. And I think a lot of the workers out there on the ground, this is some of the most dangerous working environments that we have, and we need to keep those workers safe, and they need to know what kind of conditions they're working in. And if they are exposed, it needs to be, the contractors that employ them need to be held accountable. Consistently, Bechtel and others have downplayed the risks out there. Of course, right? They don't want to admit that it might be management's fault for some of these accidents. And the workers often pay the price, as we know. So, that is a very important part of the story as well. And those are the workers, and then you have the technical staff and the scientific staff that isn't necessarily on the ground. And they have the same vision as we do as well. And many of them, some of them, of course, are in denial about the severity of the issue, but others are not. And a lot of them that I've talked to, that I write about, are very concerned about the future of Hanford and the risks that it poses, and the money that's being spent. And a lot of these are conservative Republicans that are very concerned about the price tag and want, taxpayer money to be spent properly. And I think we can all agree on that. Right now, the price tag out there is $677 billion. A few years ago it was 400 billion. Years before that it was 200 billion. I think by the end of the decade it'll be over a trillion. I mean, it's astronomical how much money is going to have to go into this project. So we need to have oversight. We need to have accountability.
Another untold story of Hanford, and one featured in the Atomic Bamboozle film, is its role in the nuclear power industry, including now campaigns to revive nuclear power, the so-called renaissance in nuclear power, or small modular nuclear reactors. Can you say something about that ongoing story of its role in nuclear power and current claims that nuclear power and specifically small reactors are our salvation in confronting the climate emergency?
Sure. Well, first, I guess I'd like to just acknowledge that I think a lot of people that tangentially support atomic energy as an answer for climate change are really coming from a good place. I think that they're very concerned about the climate. I think they want an answer, and when they're presented with an easy fix, well, of course. I mean, why wouldn't you embrace an easy fix, especially a technology that we've had for a really long time, right? That, look, we've had this, it's up and running, we can solve the climate crisis. Great. Let's seal the deal. Let's get it done. Well,
That's a
again.
generous assessment
Well,
of a mass delusion.
but I think a lot of the younger generation, I think that's where they're coming from. They are coming from a good place. Not the industry itself, of course. But then when you dig a little further, you realize no matter what kind of reactor, a big reactor, a small reactor, there's still uranium mining, which is, disastrous, especially the native lands, and it has a colonial legacy here in the US. You look at the time frame for rolling this out, even the most rosiest projections aren't going to impact the climate. We're not going to get these things up and running in time. And then you start looking at the potential for accidents, right? We've had a lot of examples of accidents, a lot of them that are unknown, and a lot of them that aren't. We have the waste issue, which there really is no answer for what to do with this type of waste and keep it safe for as long as it's radioactive. And then you have this new thing that I think a lot of people aren't really talking about, which is reactors in war zones are now to use as tools of weapons. I mean, Zaporizhzhia in Ukraine is now a tool of war. And who's to say that that's not going to happen in the future? If we had hundreds of these plants in new places and new conflict zones, it's unbelievable. I mean, right now, Taiwan, might be a new frontier, or a confrontation between the US and China. Taiwan has plants, nuke plants. So how are they? No one can guarantee those aren't going to be in a war zone. And the risk is just astronomical. And on top of that, there's this myth that atomic energy is reliable, right? Well, it's not reliable. Just look at France last year. France is often seen as this perfect, nuclear state in the world. Most of their power, or a lot of their power, is generated from atomic energy. Well, last summer during the massive heat wave in Europe, they had to take off half of their plants offline because of corrosion issues. And then most of them were actually taken off because the rivers where they were drawing water to cool down the reactors, the rivers were too warm to cool down the reactors. So you have these rivers that are heating up because of climate change, and they're supposedly the answer to climate change, but they can't run because the rivers are too hot. One after another, there's just so many reasons why atomic energy needs to be opposed, whether it's a big, huge traditional reactor or small reactors. They pr still produce waste, they still require uranium mining, and they're still very, very risky operations. And as many problems that there are with solar farms and other things, which I'm very critical of, especially in wild areas, they none of them pose the same risks as atomic energy, none of them. And I think that's something that we need to grapple with. If we are trying to come up with solutions for solving the climate crisis, we need to come up with solutions that aren't going to also bring along a lot of baggage and potentially, catastrophic accidents that could follow. I mean, that's to me, it's just a no-brainer. And I hope people will think about that. And this isn't even getting into the cost issue.
There's just so many reasons why we need to oppose atomic energy as a solution for the climate. We haven't even gotten into the issue of how much this is co will cost. you know, the time frame for these things, even if we're supposed to believe all the propaganda that comes thrown at us, the fact that this stuff can't get rolled out in time to affect the climate is a real big one as well. So, I, you know, when I talk to people about this, I just like to throw the kitchen sink at them and say, look at all these problems that can potentially come from this. But, you know, this whole conversation changes tomorrow if the backup generators in Zaporizhia fail. I don't think people understand that the waste that's produced from atomic energy consistently has to be cool. So if a plant loses electricity, which has been the case at Zaporizhia time and again, they have to rely on backup generators. Well, in the case of Zaporizhia, they're relying on these old Soviet diesel generators that are just chugging along. And there is a million things that can go wrong with these things. And if they fail, all bets are off and you could have a meltdown out there. And if we have a meltdown out there, which I do not want to see happen, this conversation changes, I think, overnight. And just like it did, I think, Chernobyl did in the 80s when the anti-nuke movement was really gaining steam. Chernobyl just closed the door on future plants in the U.S. But that door is now open. And I just saw a poll yesterday that 52% of Americans now support atomic energy. And that's pretty scary. And I think that we need to throw a lot of cold water on this and try to cool the hot waste that's coming out of the pro nuke industry,
which is an important reason for this documentary film project that includes a discussion of the anti-nuclear movement and lessons from that led to the closure of Trojan and also the Hanford legacy. And we're so delighted that you'll be joining us at the Hollywood Cinema Theater on Sunday, May 21st, 3 to 5 p.m. Tickets are on sale at that site. Yeah. And also at the June 7th screening at Kiggins Theater in Vancouver. Before we close, say a bit about why your book was selected for the Revolutionary Read program at the Vancouver Public Library System, which I didn't know they even had a revolutionary program.
I didn't either, and I was very excited. So if you're in the Vancouver region, you can go to any of the branches. I can't remember how many branches there are, but there are a lot of them, a dozen or so. Yeah, Washougal all the way almost to Richland and the Vancouver area as well. You can go to any of the libraries and pick up a copy of Atomic Days for free. They have hundreds of copies that they're giving away, and there's a number of different events that are coming up. I'm going to be up there after the Kiggins event. I'm going to be doing a talk at one of the libraries, and there's a lot of virtual events as well. So you can go to their website and learn about that. It's very cool that they're doing this, and I'm honored to be a part of it. And I'm also honored to be a part of the screening of your great film, which I think is a really important, adds to the debate. And I think a lot of the history that isn't really covered a lot about what, you know, leading up to what we're doing, dealing with today. I think that we need to understand the past in order to fight for the future.
We'll be, of course, taking you up on your claim that you have something hopeful to say about our hope in hard times. And so we'll be discussing the prospects of reviving an anti-nuclear movement in our region. And
great. The hope that I have is that the more that we're talking about this, the more that we're pushing back against the propaganda, that the more people will come out and understand how serious this issue is and why they need to get involved, because it is a growing threat worldwide. I mean, we didn't even get into the conversation about the tie between atomic energy and atomic weapons, which is intricately linked, not only at the nuclear sense, but also in the financial sense. One industry funds another. In France, the biggest atomic weapons country in Europe, their industries are deeply tied, and it's the same here in the U.S. So from a progressive anti-war perspective, it's also very important for us to oppose atomic energy, because it also will fight against the proliferation of atomic weapons as well.
So you'll be at these screening events to participate in the discussion on on your work and the prospects for a vision of the future based on Indigenous justice and climate justice. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to it, and I can't wait to be up in Portland.
Okay. See you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.